Hello, my name is Bella Lapp, and I'm a student project manager at the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues. I am joined today by Professor Joshua Tucker, professor of politics at NYU. Tucker is presenting tonight's program titled Combating Online Harms, the Importance of Rigorous Scientific Testing of Proposed Interventions.
Thank you so much for having me here today.
So my first question is kind of just to give some context about where and what kind of work you do at NYU. So I saw that you were slash are one of the first co-directors and co-founders of the Center for Social Media, AI, and Politics now. So could you talk a bit about what motivated you and your co-workers, I guess, to start that up?
Sure. So I got interested in social media about 12 years ago. My background is in studying comparative political behavior in post-communist countries. So I studied things like voting in elections and public opinion formation and partisanship. And in the late 2000s, the first decade of the 2000s, I was following the colored revolutions as they were taking place in Eastern Europe. And these were a series of protests that had broken out across in like Slovakia and Serbia, and then most famously in Ukraine and Georgia and Kyrgyzstan, where people came out onto the streets to protest electoral fraud. And while I was getting involved with doing some research on that and writing a bit about it, I started participating in panels with people who studied protest in the region, you know, as their main focus of study. And one thing that I heard over and over again was that this was not going to happen in Russia. And then one day in 2011, we woke up and there were like a quarter of a million people on the street in Moscow protesting against electoral fraud in the recent Russian legislative elections. And I got in touch with people I knew who were in Moscow, and I was asking them, like, kind of like, what's going on here? And the answer was, oh, this was all sort of organized online, and particularly on Facebook. And for the first time, I started thinking that if you really wanted to understand political behavior, you might need to know something about social media. This was also the time of the Arab Spring, where there was getting more and more attention about YouTube and Twitter as well, in terms of being a spur to political participation. And in fact, that moment of time, it's hard to kind of think about it today, but when you look back on it, that was a moment of time that people were incredibly optimistic about social media and its contributions to democracy and to democratic transitions. In fact, Larry Diamond famously coined this phrase and then ended up writing this book calling it liberation technology. That was what social media was going to be. It was going to be liberation technology because it was a means of communications that authoritarian regimes couldn't control. Now, that was a long time ago, and things have changed since then, and now people have all sorts of different concerns about the digital information environment. But that was what originally spurred me to get involved.
Yeah. Thank you. That makes sense. I came across the liberation technology, like, wording within my research for the topical background.
Yeah, so we actually ended up writing, we ended up a number of years later after the 2016 U.S. elections, where everyone in the United States kind of lost their minds about social media and its impact on democracy. Yeah. We ended up writing an article that we called From Liberation to Turmoil that was essentially, you know, how do we get from social media in 2011 being liberation technology to in 2016 or 2017 after the election, people were publishing articles in the exact same journal where Larry Diamond had published the liberation technology. His colleague and my future co-author, Nate Persily, published a piece that was called Can Democracy Survive the Internet? And so we looked at this piece, and we tried to understand, you know, was social media liberation technology? Was social media, can democracy survive the internet? And we ultimately argued in that piece that if you take kind of make just two assumptions about social media, one is that it gives voice to people who are excluded by from mainstream media, either by the state or by the economics of it. And if you make the assumption that despite the fact that social media democratizes people's access to information, but it can still be used as a tool for censorship, then you can understand how social media can actually be simultaneously both in the context of authoritarian regimes, it can play a role as kind of liberation technology, but in the context of democratic regimes, it can also be quite threatening to democracy if you think about who's excluded from access to mainstream media in these different circumstances.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. That makes sense. And then this kind of a personal curiosity, but from how do you imagine large companies like Meta could be encouraged to provide data and have more transparency and access to researchers to that data when their gatekeeping of data is kind of also like a gatekeeping of money?
Yeah, that, I mean, that's a phenomenally interesting question. I've spent a lot of time over the last like 8 years or even 10 years now at this point, essentially doing just that, publicly advocating for more access to researchers. So here's basically the argument why we have to do this, right? Mm-hmm. If only the platforms have access to the data that's on the platforms, then only the platforms are going to be able to gain insight to that, to be able to do research on what's happening on the platforms. And one thing we know about platforms is they're beholden to their shareholders. They're trying to make money. Mm-hmm. And what they share with the public is not going to be guided by the public's need to know. It's going to be guided by the concerns of the company. Yeah. And so therefore, if we as a public want to understand what is happening on these platforms, we have to support research to try to understand what's going on in these platforms. And in many cases, that research involves access to data. Mm-hmm. Nate Persily and I, the one I was mentioning a minute ago, we co-edited this volume, Social Media and Democracy, and the final chapter of the volume was all about data access. Yeah. And we essentially argued that, you know, that because policymakers need to know what's happening on these platforms in order to be able to make effective policy, mm-hmm. that it's in the public's interest to know what is happening on these platforms so that mm-hmm. the public can be informed in their preferences over what policies policymakers need to know. And so what we argued is that researchers needed essentially to be doing, there were three options for researchers. One was to conduct research without the cooperation of the platforms. Mm-hmm. That has advantages, disadvantages, and there are, you know, concerns from doing that. Mm-hmm. The second was to conduct research with the cooperation of the platforms when the platforms were willing to cooperate. That has advantages, disadvantages to it. But the third, and this is a roundabout answer to your question, the third was to advocate for policymakers mm-hmm. that they require platforms to make this data available. And, you know, I would argue that there is precedent here, right, for mm-hmm. the government and the state coming and saying to companies, look, you are benefiting from the public goods that the state provides to you. Mm-hmm. Therefore, you have to kick something back to the state, right? We call that corporate taxes, right? Mm-hmm. We make companies give some of their profit back to the state. And so Nate and I argued in that particular chapter, we were saying, you know, why not think about this in terms of data? That yes, these platforms, they built these incredible products that people really want to use. Mm-hmm. And as a result, they get to collect all this data about people who are on those platforms. But what if we said that some percentage of that data has to be put into a repository mm-hmm. where other people can analyze it? And there's all sorts of different reasons why you wouldn't want, for monopolistic reasons, why you wouldn't want the platforms to be the only ones who can gain insights from what's going on. And I think it's a particularly important question because the nature of social media is that there is so much data mm-hmm. on these platforms, right? And so if you don't have the ability to look at it systematically mm-hmm. in a rigorous kind of scientific way, what ends up happening is that because these platforms are huge, because they're optimized for search, people can go and find examples of anything on it, yeah. right? And that leads to the temptation where we make policy and we increase knowledge off of anecdotes. Mm-hmm. Somebody goes looking for something, they can find an example of something, but we don't know, is that a trend over time? We don't know what the denominator is. We don't know what the causal relationship is. And for many of these things, right, we need as external researchers, if we're going to inform the public, the press, if we're going to inform policymakers, we need to be able to get access to this data. And at the end of the day, if you follow those first two paths, mm-hmm. either accessing data and conducting research without the cooperation of the platforms, or accessing data and cooperating with the platforms, to some extent, no matter which of those things you do, you're sort of at the mercy of the platforms. Because if you're scraping data, the platforms can, sometimes because they want to prevent you from scraping data, but sometimes because of totally different reasons that they're just doing something else, they can change the way the data is formatted and all of a sudden your scraping doesn't work, right? Yeah. If you're working with platforms, and I've had the experience of doing that, there's all sorts of potential pitfalls in there and you have to be really, really careful before you get into these kind of collaborations mm-hmm. that you're not going to fall into these particular types of pitfalls. So, and ultimately, you know, I was part of this project called the U.S. 2020 Facebook and Instagram Election Study, mm-hmm. which was this incredible opportunity that we had to do all these kinds of studies around the 2020 election. But our hope in doing that was that there'd be a U.S. 2024, there'd be a U.S. 2028, that maybe TikTok or YouTube would then say, oh, look at this model. Like, it's a really valuable model. This is a way that we can be cooperating with people who want to understand the platforms. But so far, that thing has been a one-shot deal. So it's like, we can say, look at that, and it produced all this valuable scientific information, but it doesn't mean that it's going to happen again. So it's weird, because when we wrote that in the book in 2020, I thought by far the sort of least likely thing to be able to happen was that we would be able to convince governments that they should put regulation in place that forces the platforms to share data. But the more time that goes on, the more I think that that's more and more important, because these other pathways are just, they're always fraught. And we've seen the European Union actually put some policies into place. Now, they're not quite working yet the way I think people want them to work, but we have seen some motion in that regard.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. I thought it was very interesting also, kind of what jump-started my interest in the topic of, I mean, I've always been interested, but in this topic was I watched Adolescence last year, and then I saw all the news cycles about how that show was able to kind of start the conversation in the UK about online safety, and that was able to affect like lobbying and stuff and then be integrated into their education and everything. And I just thought that was super cool. So it definitely makes sense that that's...
Yeah, I mean, the study... So
kind of the way to do it.
You raise an interesting point there, right? Because there's the... And we don't study in our lab public policy, right? We're a nonpartisan lab. We don't advocate for policy other than that researchers should get access to data, right? Yeah. So that we can continue to do this type of work. But people who study public policy, it is interesting all the different things that kind of contribute and can catalyze public policies. And you're right, sometimes a television show can actually end up doing that.
Yeah.
As researchers, you know, one of the things that we hope is that our research will be able to do that. And actually at the Center for Social Media, AI, and Politics, our mission statement is like, it's threefold. One is to do rigorous scientific research at the intersection of the digital information environment and politics so that we can get this kind of rigorous information. So we get away from these like anecdotal observations and can talk about things like causality. But the second part of our mission statement is to try to inform public policymakers, right? And so we're happy to talk to policymakers whenever, again, we don't lobby them in favor of particular policies, but we're happy to share what we've learned. And we always try to put our research out there into the public so that journalists can access it, so the public can access it, so the policymakers can access it. And then the third part of our mission statement is to train the next generation of scholars, which is, you know, super, super important to us.
Thank you. That makes sense. And then my third question, from your understanding, how is content moderation carried out on some of the largest platforms like Facebook and Instagram?
Yeah. So content moderation is a huge question. I'll back up a second here, and I'm going to give you a framework for thinking about the challenge that content moderation poses from a political standpoint. Right. There's lots we can think about content moderation from a mental health standpoint, from a public health standpoint. We can think about it in terms of health misinformation. We can think about it in terms of things that are blatantly illegal. So like one thing to start with is that all platforms do content moderation. Right. Child pornography is illegal in the United States. You cannot post child pornography on these platforms and they will all remove it. So what they do in addition to that is the question here. But here's the uniquely political way to think about it. When you talk to the mass public and you say something along the lines of, well, content moderation shouldn't be biased in terms of politics, right? What do you think of when you hear that? I think most people, when they hear something shouldn't be biased, you should be like, well, if it's not a biased system, it's probably pulling down 50% of content from the left and 50% of content for the right. Like that feels fair. But that's not actually what bias means, right? So that would be not biased if 50% of the content that violated the content rules on the platform was produced by the right and 50% of the content was produced by the left. But if you have a situation where there's asymmetric production of content by different sides of the political spectrum, right, then what it actually means to be not politically biased, right, that would mean not taking account of politics when you pull down the content. You just pull down content that violates your content moderation standards. But if one side is producing 80% of the content that violates those standards and the other side is producing 20% of the content, then being not politically biased actually means pulling down 80% from one side and 20% from the other. If you pulled down 90 and 10, that would be biased because you'd be penalizing the stuff that was on one the side that was producing 80 more. But it also, if you pulled down 70 and 30, that would be being politically biased because you would be artificially upping the amount of stuff that you pull down on the side that's not producing as much. So the weird thing about content moderation is that it's always kind of a slow-moving train wreck about to happen, because if you really are not politically biased, then the only way that's going to look like to the public that you're being fair is if you happen to be living in a world where you're lucky enough that the left and the right are both violating these at the same rate. If you're violating it at different rates, then it's going to look, if you're really not politically biased, it's going to look like you're not fair. So this has caused a problem for platforms over the years. And what we have seen is that platforms address this in different ways. And again, thinking about it at a high level, right, you can think of platforms as being more aggressive about removing content misinformation or whatever violates their policies and being less aggressive about it. Right now, we're in a much less aggressive phase in the United States where the platforms since the 2024 elections have all taken steps, and since Musk bought Twitter, in particular, Musk started this, have taken steps to say we've gone too far in terms of the content moderation. Right around the time of the COVID pandemic, you saw a big surge in platforms really not wanting to be responsible for sharing health misinformation that was going to lead to people dying. So we see these different swings. If you're asking more of a logistical question of how does content moderation work, it's clearly, and has been for a long time, it's a result of machines and humans working in different combinations with each other. But those machines and humans are working to implement the rules, and those rules we've seen have changed. And what's even more complicated is that there are different rules in different parts of the world. And it's not just a simple question to be like, well, normatively, we want, you know, more aggressive content moderation because that means we're not going to have health misinformation. Like, we could all agree that not having stuff online that's like going to scam people or going to, you know, harm people's health is a good idea. But if you go to the extreme and you're like, okay, well, you should just do whatever the country says, well, then we get back to liberation technology, right? So if you're Facebook and you're in a part of the world where there's a dictatorship and they say, oh, well, our content moderation rules are nothing critical of the government, then do you have it? So it's a complicated question. I think it's very challenging for these social media platforms, especially the ones that got so big so quickly, right, in that they went suddenly were global. And there are, you know, people tend to look at this from a very US-centered viewpoint, but there are global implications to this discussion as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. I was looking at the 2015 article you contributed to about echo chambers online. In this article, the conclusion posits that there's some ideological symmetry in the structure and function of online political communication. Is that kind of what you were talking about?
Is this
disappearing into like a kind of different
area? Okay, so that's a different art. So that in that particular article, that was, so what you get into this concept of echo chambers.
Yes.
So one of the reasons that people think that social media might be bad for democracy is because it puts people into echo chambers. So what, and that's, those are both postulates. But one, that it does put people in echo chambers, and two, that would be bad for democracy.
Yeah.
So the argument here goes that when you go online, you end up finding other people who are like you politically. You end up in communities of people who are like you politically. And then you end up, because you are in communities that are like you politically, that ends up having negative implications for democracy. Why would it have negative implications for democracy? Some people would argue that it could accentuate political polarization. Because when somebody says something critical about the other party, if you're in an echo chamber, maybe there's no one around to defend them. Other people have argued that it has kind of a ratcheting effect, that if you're trying to get attention online and you're only in a community with leftists, that the more extreme positions get more attention. And so everyone keeps becoming more and more extreme. And that if you weren't in an echo chamber, that wouldn't happen. There are other concerns about this as well, right? But that's basically the argument. But for a long time, you know, we've haven't known whether that argument was correct. So one question was, are people actually in echo chambers? And so that 2015 article, that tweeting from left to right article that we wrote, that was really about trying to understand a way of trying to get at, were people in echo chambers? And what we had done And I neglected to mention earlier on when you asked me on the podcast about how I got interested in this. The other reason I got interested in this was I had this like brilliant graduate student, Pablo Barbera, who wrote this paper for a class that I was in, that I was teaching, suggesting that you could use people's follower networks on Twitter to estimate their partisanship. And so we took his method. He's the lead, was the lead author on this article. Mm-hmm. And we took his method and we estimated lots of people's ideology on Twitter. And then we looked across like 12 different issues. Mm-hmm. And what we tried to see was when people were retweeting people, were they retweeting only, were liberals only retweeting liberals and were conservatives only retweeting conservatives? Mm-hmm. And so what we found in that article, and you would think from the echo chamber story that that's what's happening. Mm-hmm. So we didn't find that that was the case in that article. What we found was a much more nuanced story. Mm-hmm. And actually it was super interesting because as you went from less political issues, like we collected a whole bunch of tweets about the Oscars and the mm-hmm. Super Bowl, there was a lot of tweeting, retweeting across ideological lines. As things got more political, like the State of the Union address, mm-hmm. it became, there was less of this retweeting across political lines. Mm-hmm. And even in some of the issues, I don't know if you remember this, but there was this absolutely tragic shooting at the Newtown Elementary School in Connecticut. Mm-hmm. And that, even within that, when people were tweeting about that, in the beginning, in the first few days, mm-hmm. when it was everyone just feeling horrible about what had happened and talking about the kids and prayers and that kind of stuff, there was a lot of tweeting across ideological lines. Mm-hmm. But as time went on and people started talking about changing gun control laws, mm-hmm. then the tweeting became more political. So it was kind of like an interesting nuanced story. You brought up the question about ideological asymmetries. In that particular paper, we did find that there were more people on the left who were retweeting people on the right than vice versa. But I wouldn't make too much of that because it may have been the case that that just means that people on the left are more obnoxious and they're more likely to like quote tweet someone and say bad things about it. And actually we wrote another paper with a different team a number of years later where we looked at a whole different set of data. But we actually did find that a lot of the time when there was this cross-partisan tweeting going on, mm-hmm. That it would have some of the, a portion of that would be quote tweets. And mm-hmm. so if you were, I forget what the numbers exactly were, but I think it was about if you retweeted someone on your side, it was like a 10% likelihood that you quote tweeted them. Mm-hmm. But if you retweeted someone on the other side, it was like a 30% likelihood that you quote tweeted them. Yeah. And then those quote tweets from the other side, a big chunk of them would be sort of negative comments about it. So, so it's kind of, it's a complex story in there. But just to talk about the echo chambers again, we did in this US 2020 Facebook and Instagram election study, we actually were able to do an experiment during the 2020 election where we took consenting participants, people that agreed to participate in the study, and we randomized some of them. We didn't tell them what treatments they were being randomized, but they knew something was going to happen in their feed. And we tried to test this theory of, and actually I'm going to talk about this tonight at the lecture today, but we tested this theory about that maybe getting people out of echo chambers mm-hmm. would make them less polarized. Mm-hmm. And so we did an experimental treatment where for the people who were in the treatment group, they saw less content mm-hmm. from politically like-minded people on Facebook. Mm-hmm. And it had absolutely no difference, made no impact on their polarization. So don't tell anyone else in the audience, but we'll go over, I'll present that tonight. But so that's a super interesting paper. There's also really interesting stuff in this, in that paper. It's called Like-Minded. It's Brendan Nyhan's the lead author, and it appeared mm-hmm. In Nature in the summer of 2023. Mm-hmm. And there's really, really, really interesting descriptive data in there, which actually, after having done the paper you asked me about all those years ago, I thought, well, echo chambers are a little overblown. Mm-hmm. And then having looked at some of the data from Facebook in 2020, mm-hmm. I was actually updated a little bit more in terms of like the percentage of people who, you know, there were definitely asymmetries. More people were in friend groups with people who were politically similar to them than people who were not politically similar to them.
Thank you. That answer kind of makes me feel a little bit better. I also, reading your articles, reading the election study made me feel a little bit better because I went into this research feeling very doom and gloom and echo chambers and pipelines and everything's going terrible. But yeah, talking to you kind of opens up the nuance in it. So I really appreciate that.
Thanks. Yeah, no, I mean, I think this is, you know, again, this goes back to the challenge of social media because it's an interesting thing. Like normally when you're in a biology class and like you're studying yeast, you don't spend your days like with yeast. Yeah. I mean, like, you don't think about it that much, but like everybody is on, like most of the people who are thinking about social media and thinking about it critically are on social media. Mm-hmm. And we all get such a myopic view of what social media looks like through our own, I mean, if you look at my social media feed, it's like, oh, everybody's interested in politics. Yeah. We know as political scientists, like most people aren't interested in politics at all. But if you're a political scientist and you're friends with people you know from work, like it looks like everybody's interested in politics. And so we get these kind of myopic feed. And then the other part of it too is that like, you know, again, I haven't done systematic research on this, so take this with a grain of salt. But I think one of these things that happens is, again, when something happens on social media, something bad, for example, or something good, mm-hmm. and people go looking for it, mm-hmm. right, you can find it.
Yeah.
And then you can write a story about it. Mm-hmm. And then people read that story, and you don't get the context of whether it's common. And it might be that it's very common on that day.
Yeah.
But it's not very common over time. It might be that it's actually not that common, period. It's just like something happened on it. But we read about it and then we remember it and we extrapolate out our brains. It might be that it's common in your country, but not in other countries. And so, it again, going back to like why we need this kind of data access is because in that US 2020 study, we were able to essentially get statistics on the entire adult population in the United States on Facebook. That's not who we ran the experiments on. We ran the experiments on people who we recruited to join the study and who participated in the study. But like, that's the only moment in time that we've ever had that vision of Facebook. Like, we don't know what it's like in the 6 years since, and we don't know what it was like in the 12 years before that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you. That's all the questions that I have for you today.
Oh, thanks so much for having me here.
Yeah, thank you so much for sitting down for the interview with me. And I'm really looking forward to the talk.